Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again and welcome back. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington with the program that helps you learn American English. At the same time, we tell you about interesting things that are happening around the world. Today, we will travel to Vietnam. Business activity is improving, but there are some negative effects to the environment. Then we'll travel across the Pacific Ocean to Hawaii to hear how climate change is affecting the shark population. Let's get started with part one. Vietnam's move from poverty to a fast-growing economy has caused harm to the environment. In the future, young people will be among those worst affected by the pollution. But as we hear from Ashley Thompson, some young people are taking action to change things.
Long Binh Bridge is one of the most famous structures in the Vietnamese capital, Hanoi. On a recent day, the footpath along the bridge was lined with people, all wearing similar T-shirts. They call themselves the CARP team. Some carried signs with the message, "Don't drop nylon bags with the fish." One of them was 22-year-old Lei Thi Lai. She says it is a tradition for Vietnamese to release three fish 7 days before the start of Tet, the Lunar New Year. She says the fish are for the kitchen god, a spirit that lives in the home of every family. She says they will join the kitchen god when he returns to report back to the Jade Emperor. Lei Thi Lai says the problem is that many people release both the fish and the plastic bag they came in. This not only pollutes the environment, but can kill the fish. The CARP team's solution is to lower the fish down to the waterside so they can be released there. The team also collects the plastic waste so it can be reused. The students are not only active during Tet. 21-year-old Huang Hong Vi is another member of the CARP team. She says the team supports Earth Hour, a program of the Worldwide Fund for Nature. She says they also are making plans for an event in June to raise interest in the issue of water pollution. Their work is just part of the activism that has grown in recent years because of rising concern over environmental issues. Vietnam's economic growth has led to polluted waterways and extensive loss of wildlife. The country rated 136 out of 178 countries on the 2014 Environmental Performance Index. The index measures what countries are doing to protect the environment and human health from environmental damage. Vietnam was given a rating of 170 for air quality, but its air pollution is not as severe as that in many Chinese cities. Nguyen Chi Theng is with the Asia Foundation. He says environmental problems are worsening in Vietnam's big cities like Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City. He says a growing number of Vietnamese are becoming concerned about the environment because it affects their lives and their children.
In Hanoi, you can see some, you know, at intersection, a few young people, you know, with banners say, you know, if you stop your bike for more than 30 seconds, you can just turn it off to save the energy and save the environment. I think they really concerned about and the you know, the way people behave. They really try to, you know, promote the green behaviors among the people living in big cities right now.
Air pollution is a major concern for families in the big cities. Engines in cars and motorcycles are one of the leading pollution causes in Vietnam. The problem may worsen as traffic increases. Local media say the country now has about 37 million registered motorcycles, up from 32 million in 2008. Vietnamese officials have recognized the problem. The government plans to tighten pollution controls for automobiles in 2017 and again in 2022. But Nguyen Chi Thanh says reducing air pollution is not a top goal at this time. He says the government is putting more efforts into fighting water pollution.
I know some people in Ministry of Environment and Natural Resources, they are working on, you know, some kind of regulation, a more stricter regulation on air pollution, but it's not coming out yet.
Lei Thi Lai from the CARP team says she thinks protecting the environment should not be the responsibility of one group of people. Pollution affects everyone, she says, so it is everyone's responsibility to do something about it. I'm Ashley Thompson.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Fishing, climate change, and pollution threaten many shark species. Now, scientists are getting a close look at the shark environment. They want to better understand the threats this important animal faces. Marcia James tells us what scientists are doing in Hawaii.
The University of Hawaii research site is on Coconut Island in Hawaii. It is just minutes by motorboat from the shore of Oahu, the most populated of the Hawaiian islands. The facility is a good place to observe sharks, since they are native to local waters. Some are being kept in this sheltered bay for study. Carl Meyer researches shark behavior.
When sharks are feeding, and hopefully how much they're eating, and that's what we use these captive animals for.
Scientists also observe the behavior of sharks in the open ocean. They place a sensor device in their food to observe the digestion process. They also measure the animals. Then the researchers release the sharks with electronic tracking devices attached to their fins. The researchers study tiger sharks, sandbar sharks, black tip sharks, and many others. They recently attached a camera to a sandbar shark to record its everyday activities.
When we recovered the camera, we saw that the shark had spent the day in a large aggregation of sharks, not just sandbar sharks, but also black tip sharks and many, many scalloped hammerhead sharks.
Sharks are quick and deadly, but rarely attack humans. Carl Meyer says those rare attacks receive heavy media coverage and are dramatized in movies like 1975's Jaws. He says sharks are important top-level hunters. They help keep a balance in ocean ecosystems. Pollution, climate change, and fishing threaten those systems. Many fishermen target sharks for the Asian food market. Fishermen also sometimes kill sharks in the process of hunting other species. The scientists at University of Hawaii study endangered sharks and those at risk of endangerment. Carl Meyer says that humans are more of a risk to sharks than sharks are a risk to humans.
Because never before in the natural history of the world have we seen a species become so dominant and so able to alter the natural environment.
And he says the results of those environmental changes cannot always be predicted. I'm Marcia James.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. This is VOA, the Voice of America. Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Environment and Science Report. Many areas of cropland in Bangladesh are becoming unfit for farming. The land is becoming salty. It is a big problem for the small country. More than 155 million people live in Bangladesh. Growing crops is the most common way Bangladeshis support themselves. Farmers in the country are learning to grow vegetables in so-called vertical gardens. The soil in these gardens is better because heavy rains have removed much of the salt. The village of Chandipur is in southwestern Bangladesh. Pumpkins and other gourds grow on vines on top of small homes. The vegetables get the food they need from soil placed in containers on the ground. Shobita Debna is a 35-year-old farmer in the village. Her garden space is very small, but she is able to grow hundreds of kilograms of vegetables each season.
Beet kopi, palon shag, wool kopi. Jhal, piaz, roshun, dharosh.
She says she grows gourds, including pumpkin, as well as green beans, red amaranth, beets, carrots, cauliflower, and more. Miss Debna depends on the vegetables to earn money. She makes a few dollars a day. This kind of farming is new in Chandipur, but it may spread across the country. Most of Bangladesh is at or below sea level. Rising sea waters linked to climate change has severely affected the country. High water from storms in coastal areas also adds salt to soil. High salt content makes crops less productive. The flow of seawater from storms like Cyclone Ila in 2009 damaged much of the soil and farm areas. The salty water flows into rivers, which then flood Chandipur and other villages. Vegetable crops fail. For 3 years now, hundreds of villagers have grown crops in vertical gardens. The international nonprofit group World Fish Center brought vertical gardens to Bangladesh. Dr. Craig Meisner is the South Asia Country Director for World Fish Center. He told VOA, "There is no country with such population density where natural resources are stretched to their very limits." He says if climate change adaptation fails in Bangladesh, it is sure to fail in many other countries. However, he says, if it succeeds, it gives hope for the world's future. World Fish Center has trained about 200 villagers in southwestern Bangladesh to make vertical gardens. And that's the VOA Learning English Environment and Science Report. I'm Marcia James.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the late 1800s, white Americans expanded their settlements in the western part of the country. They claimed land traditionally used by American Indians. The Indians were hunters, and they struggled to keep control of their hunting lands. The federal government supported the settlers' claims. It fought and won several wars with Indian tribes. It forced the Indians to live on government-controlled reservations. This week in our series, Larry West and Steve Ember tell about the people who settled on the old Indian lands after the wars.
After the Indians were defeated, thousands of settlers hurried west. Some hoped to find new, rich farmland. The soil they left behind was thin and overworked. Their crops were poor. Some simply hoped to buy any kind of farmland. They did not have enough money to buy farmland in the East. Others came from other countries and hoped to build new lives in the United States. All the settlers found it easy to get land in the West. In 1862, Congress had passed the Homestead Act. This law gave every citizen and every foreigner who asked for citizenship the right to claim government land. The law said each man could have 65 hectares. If he built a home on the land and farmed it for 5 years, it would be his. He paid just $10 to record the deal.
Claiming land on the Great Plains was easy. Building a farm there and working it was not so easy. The wide, flat grasslands seemed strange to men who had lived among the hills and forests of the East. Here there were few hills or trees. Without trees, settlers had no wood to build houses. Some built houses partly underground. Others built houses from blocks of earth cut out of the grassland. These houses were dark and dirty. They leaked and became muddy when it rained. There were no fences on the Great Plains, so it was hard to keep animals away from crops.
Settlers in the American West also had a problem faced by many people in the world today. They had little fuel for heating and cooking. With few trees to cut for fuel, they collected whatever they could find. Small woody plants, dried grass, cattle and buffalo wastes. Water was hard to find, too. And although the land seemed rich, it was difficult to prepare for planting. The grass roots were thick and strong. They did not break apart easily. The weather also was a problem. Sometimes months would pass without rain, and the crops would die. Winters were bitterly cold.
Most of the settlers, however, were strong people. They did not expect an easy life. And as time passed, they found solutions to most of the problems of farming on the Great Plains. Railroads were built across the West. They brought wood for homes, wood and coal for fuel. technology solved many of the problems. New equipment was invented for digging deep wells. Better pumps were built to raise the water to the surface. Some of the pumps used windmills for power.
The fence problem was solved in 1874. That was the year barbed wire was invented. The sharp metal barbs tore the skin of the men who stretched it along fence tops, but they prevented cattle from pushing over the fences and destroying crops. New farm equipment was invented. This included a plow that could break up the grassland of the plains. And farmers learned techniques for farming in dry weather.
Most of the problems on the plains could be solved, but solving them cost money. A farmer could get wood to build his house, but he had to buy the wood and pay the railroad to bring it west. To farm the plains, he needed barbed wire for fences and plows and other new equipment. All these things cost money. So a plains farmer had to grow crops that were in big demand. He usually put all his efforts into producing just one or two crops.
The farmers of the plains did well at first. There was enough rain. Huge crops of wheat and corn were produced. Much of the grain was sold in Europe, and farmers got good prices. The farmers, however, were not satisfied. They were angry about several things. One was the high cost of sending their crops to market. The only way to transport their grain was by railroad, and railroad prices were very high for farm products, higher than for anything else. The railroads also owned the big buildings where grain was stored. Farmers had to pay to keep their grain there until it was sold. They said storage costs were too high.
The farmers were angry about the high cost of borrowing money, too. They opposed the import taxes, tariffs they had to pay on foreign products. Some of the tariffs were as high as 60%. Congress had set the levels high to protect American industry from foreign competition. But farmers said they were the victims of this policy because it increased their costs. Farmers, as individuals, could do nothing to change the situation. But if they united in a group, they thought, perhaps they could influence government policy.
Farmers began to unite in local social and cultural groups called Granges. As more and more farmers joined Granges, the groups began to act on economic problems. Farmers organized cooperatives to buy equipment and supplies in large amounts directly from factories. The cost of goods was lower when bought in large amounts. The Granges also began to organize for political action. Local Granges became part of the national Grange movement. Grange supporters won control of state legislatures in a number of Middle Western states. They passed laws to limit the cost of railroad transportation and crop storage. Railroads refused to obey these laws. They fought the measures in the courts. They did not win. Finally, they appealed to the United States Supreme Court.
The railroads said the laws were not constitutional because they interfered with the right of Congress to control trade between the states. The railroads said states could not control transportation costs. To do so would reduce profits for the railroad. And that would be the same as taking property from the railroad without legal approval. The Supreme Court rejected this argument. In a decision in 1876, the Supreme Court said states had a legal right to control costs of railroad transportation. It said owners of property in which the public has an interest must accept public control for the common good. The farmers seem to have won, but the powerful railroad companies continued to struggle against controls. They reduced some transportation costs, but only after long court fights.
The Granges tried to get Congress to pass laws giving the federal government power to control the railroads. Congress refused to act. Many farmers lost hope that the Granges could force the railroads to make any real cuts in their costs. They began to leave the organization. Others left because the economy had improved. They no longer felt a need to protest. Within a few years, the National Grange had lost most of its members. Some local groups continued to meet, but they took no part in politics. New protest groups would be formed in a few years when farmers once again faced hard times. But for now, in the late 1870s, times were good. Most people were satisfied. We will continue this story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Larry West and Steve Ember. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English. Thank you.